Bob McCowan. That's Stephen Brunt to my right. And to my left, the Deputy Commissioner of the National Hockey League, Bill Daly, is in studio. Hello, what brings you to town? Just passing through?
No, actually, I had some work to do in the office today on some of the issues associated with our officiating during the lockout and how to handle them in Toronto. But I'm using the opportunity also to talk to all the fine folks up here who care a lot about hockey.
So are we to understand that there will be no games, but officials will be working? That seems unlikely to me.
Yeah, no, that's not the case. But there are certain provisions on our collective bargaining agreement with the officials that deal with the officials. By the way, I should say this before we get too far into this.
Yes.
I had a conversation with Eugene Melnick earlier this afternoon.
Uh-oh.
And he wanted me to tell you to be take it easy on me a little bit.
Eugene
he
said
says,
that?
Yes.
Now, why would he think I wouldn't? I'm always nice to you, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
He's great.
And I've said that.
He says all kinds of stuff on this show.
Yeah.
Like, it's fantastic.
Like real news.
Well, real news. And he goes off script. I assume we won't get him during the lockout. Is that probably right?
No, you can get Eugene. He's not going to probably be talking about the lockout.
Yes. Well, you can talk to him about the weather and stuff.
Yes, but, he can talk about a lot of things.
Yeah. But just not that.
Right.
Well, I did run into him a couple of weeks ago and we had a nice chat about various things. All things that that he made me swear not to repeat on the air. So I won't.
He's a great guy and a really good owner. And that franchise has done very well under his stewardship.
Well, I think they're lucky to have him.
They are.
So Brunt and I got into this conversation earlier. It's not an issue for you. It's more of an issue for Don Fear and the Players Association. But when you see Don and 283 players or however many there were in the room the other night and this constant effort to have players behind Don when he's making presentations. Does that mean anything to you? We don't quite understand exactly what it means. And conversely, we're wondering, why don't you have your owners standing behind Gary? Well, partly because they wouldn't shut up, right?
No, I look.
Yes.
It's his style. I think it's something that's he's probably used over time, over decades of time, in which he's done that. And apparently it's been something that's been, you know, he feels is effective and sends the right message. So that you're right. That's a question for Don, not for us. I don't think it changes the substance of the issues we're dealing with.
Why don't you have your owners behind Gary?
Because we haven't felt the need or compelled to have owners stand behind Gary at press scrums. Not sure what kind of message that does convey. I mean, it's really your question. Yeah, I don't know what Don's trying to accomplish with it. We've not felt a similar need to have owners stand behind Gary.
Why? Well, but the owner, here's a point of difference that may be relevant. Historically, players are not forbidden from talking to the media about whatever they know about the events. Right. Owners, on the other hand, are verboten from Correct. Saying anything on this.
Correct.
What are you afraid of?
I don't think. I think
you have a bunch of lunatic owners who would say anything.
I think it's important to have a clear, consistent message, and that falls to the league. Look, we're principally responsible for negotiating this agreement. Obviously, we get guidance from the clubs as to what they feel like they need and they want in the agreement, but it's up to us to negotiate it, and we should be the ones communicating about it.
And this, in terms of the whole idea of getting the message out, Bill, because Bob and I were just kicking this around as well. You didn't do the big photo op with that the players did, but you know Gary certainly stands up and he tries to get a message out to the public. Certainly during the last lockout, there were dueling messages, and it was reminiscent of a. Of an election campaign in some ways, or maybe just a propaganda exercise, however you want to look at it. But it was this idea of we're preaching to the fans. We're going to say things now who don't have a vote in this thing, and maybe don't even have a dog in this fight. What is the purpose of that exercise in your mind?
Well, I think look, the fans and our business partners are our major constituents, really, both the players and the owners. I mean, they pay our salaries, right? So they deserve to hear what our message and what our rationale is. Having said that. I think we've tried to take a different approach in this negotiation than we did last time. I probably naively so, thought this was going to be a much more business-like and easier negotiation, certainly a different negotiation than we had last time. and then we would have a successful resolution. And to this point, it has not played out that way. And that's unfortunate, but we're in a situation where we're not going to be opening training camps. We're not going to be playing preseason games or regular season games until we have an agreement. And I think, you know, our fan base and our loyal business partners need to hear from us as to why. Media is the most effective way to communicate with the fans. Our business partners have been hearing from us all summer. We've kept them very well in tune to how the negotiations were progressing and what we expected to happen and what happened and what didn't happen. But you know, obviously we feel an obligation to the fans to let them know our view of things.
Let me ask a fan question then, okay? Because that's part of the exercise. You know, you guys have talked about, you know, we've been very upfront that you've had, you know, great revenue growth over the last, 3 years, 4 years, more maybe. But
6 years.
Yeah, 6 years over through some very tough economic times, you know, for mm-hmm. everybody else, especially 2008. Is that the same thing as your team's making money? Like how did your teams make money last year?
That's the right question, right? So no, it's not the same as our team's making money.
Not team by team, but overall, were you profitable last year?
I don't think we'd be having the fight that we're having if that were the case, right? So there are serious issues that need to be addressed, and we think they can be addressed fairly and with very modest adjustments. That will benefit the sport and will give us a platform to continue to grow it. And the players will benefit in that. There'll be direct beneficiaries of that, as will the clubs.
But if the last deal gave you, you know, cost certainty, at least in terms of percentage of revenue, hockey related revenues, why were those businesses not operated profitably? If you know, everybody understood, you know, the revenue went up significantly. Everybody understood how much of that revenue was going to go out to the players because that was the deal. So what's the barrier to profitability here?
Well, I think a host of factors, but one is, well, I'll start with. I mean, we didn't start at a 57% deal. We started at a 54% deal. But in hindsight or retrospect, 57% is just too much. We can't build a stable and successful business with 57% of our revenues going to the players. Now, that issue has been exacerbated over time as well by a variety of factors. You pointed to the economic downturn in 2008. That's clearly one. You know, the fact that the Canadian currency is at par, actually $1.03, I think, today, compared to 75 cents when we settled the last deal, that's another issue.
That's a good issue, though.
The cost, it's good for our Canadian clubs.
Yeah, well,
it's not necessarily good for the league when you're, it's tied into league revenues and the cap is tied into league revenues. And the cost of doing business, quite frankly, and generating those revenues have increased pretty significantly over time, too. So, I mean, the world doesn't stand still. And whether 57% was the right number at the time or not, and I'm probably the first to acknowledge it probably wasn't, it clearly isn't the right number today.
Hasn't Gary said that the Canadian dollar thing, isn't he kind of poo-pooed that, including in this studio? Didn't he say it wasn't relevant to the leap in revenue?
Yes, it was some time ago, but yes.
Well, I don't think, in fairness to Gary, I don't think that was ever his position, that it wasn't, didn't have some connection with an increase in revenue. I just think it got overstated over time as to what impact, or, you know, I think Bob's big part was what percentage of the league's overall revenue was represented by Canadian clubs.
Yeah.
And you know, we've had this discussion before on air that you were using an inflated percentage in terms of the overall percentage that our Canadian clubs generate as part of league revenue. That it doesn't mean that the inflated Canadian currency doesn't add artificially to some extent to league-wide revenue.
I want to get that clip back just some one of these days. But you just
I'm not going to be argumentative.
But
today,
if a disproportionate amount of your revenue does come from the Canadian teams, and I'm not saying we won't argue over the percentage, and if that revenue is collected in 103 cent dollars rather than 75 cent dollars, it's pretty significant, isn't it?
It's a significant portion of our revenue increase of the
yes
you know, two. 2.1 billion to 3.3 billion, you know, a not insignificant portion of that is Canadian currency. But there's also real revenue growth there. And a lot of that real revenue growth is due to the success, unbelievable and unprecedented success of the Canadian franchises. Nobody's arguing those points. They are what they are.
Bill Daly is with us, the deputy commissioner. All right, I want to get into a couple things here. when the NBA was going through their situation, correct me if I'm wrong, but the commissioner, I believe, came out and stated that the league was losing on an annual basis $300 million. Does that sound right, Brent?
I think so.
It may have been more than that.
Okay. What did the NHL lose as a group last year?
That's not something that we have talked about publicly, and I don't intend to break news here. Look, last time we were very public with respect to the financial state of our franchises. It's not something that we're talking about this time, but it is something that, you know, we've shared intimate details with Players Association, so they certainly know what the situation is.
So you won't tell us. So, but if we added up the EBITDA, would it be positive or negative?
I think I've suggested it would be negative.
Okay. If we lopped off, if we took the four weakest franchises in terms of EBITDA and lopped them off, do you think, just off the top of your head, do you think you could turn the negative into positive? And I'm going somewhere with this.
Yeah, I'm not.
Maybe?
I'm not sure I could tell you that. I do think I know where you're going with this. I mean, the issue is not a handful of franchises. The issue is much broader than that. Right, the financial issue we're dealing with, much broader than a handful of franchises. And so more directed revenue sharing or contraction potentially for clubs isn't a solution to the overall problem. There is a problem that exists. We need to find a sensible way with the Players Association to address that problem that will provide a sound basis for our collective future.
Well, but you have several problems here, I would submit. There's several things that conspire together to create the situation that we have. One is you have a group of owners who are not fiscally responsible. You have a group of owners who spend money with both hands and then cry poor. That's the perception of the public, and the evidence is there for all to see. They are signing players to contracts that are expensive under the old CBA, but now you want a CBA that puts greater controls on them, they won't do what you want them to do. That's problem number one. Problem number two is you probably have $100 million or more in losses in four franchises, and they go on and on and on, and you can put Band-Aids on them all you want, but they don't get fixed, and nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to say, all right, part of this fixing of the economics has to be the recognition that there are places where the NHL has not succeeded. And coincidentally, there are places where the NHL has a better chance of succeeding, and I'm not seeing the conversation about moving those franchises to places that could be more profitable.
Yeah, I guess we have a different philosophy in how best to run a sports league, and it's not necessarily all about taking a quick hit by moving a franchise to a different location. You know, there is, and I think you would probably acknowledge this, that when a sports league puts a franchise in a particular location,
right,
it should give that market a chance to be successful.
How long?
In that market. I don't know what the time is. Clearly, we made a judgment at the time, going back to Jim Balsillie and the bankruptcy, that we didn't believe that Phoenix had been given a fair opportunity to be successful. We thought the market is an attractive market with attractive demographics for the National Hockey League to be successful long term. We may be wrong about that. But certainly the fact that the last 3 years have gone by with the league as owner of the franchise,
right,
doesn't create doubt in the market. It really doesn't impact that judgment one way or the other. We may be wrong on the judgment, but ultimately that is the judgment you make. You try to make it work in a particular market before you abandon it.
Yeah, but there has to come a point, you would acknowledge, where you have to make that decision.
I agree.
A company as big as McDonald's opens franchises,
mm-hmm,
and sometimes they close them.
I agree.
It's hard to believe that a McDonald's franchise wouldn't work no matter where you put it, but they don't. Some of them don't. Tim Hortons on every street corner in this country, but some of them don't work.
You know what? I think a sports franchise is a little bit different.
I don't think it's a
fair analogy perfectly, but I understand the point.
And all I'm trying to say, I guess, is there seems to be a sense of reluctance to acknowledge the possibility of a mistake.
Okay. I try to be fair in these things,
Well, no, tell me what you think.
Look, my own view is I agree with the general premise of where you're going. There comes a point in time where if a franchise hasn't worked, regardless of, you have to look at the reasons why it doesn't work, right? And you've pointed to some of them. Sometimes you can have less than optimally managed franchises.
Sure.
Sometimes you can go through a period which is related to the first item where they're not successful on the ice. So you really haven't given the fans an opportunity to really engage with the franchise in a meaningful way. There are a host of reasons why you can be failing. And if you look at all those reasons and you go through them, and it's clear that all those items have been checked and the franchise is still a failure from a financial perspective, then you make that tough judgment.
But Bill, you can understand why, especially in this country where people are going to pay intense attention to this situation, to that, the last time around you guys came, you had the Leavitt report, you went to great lengths to demonstrate that you were in trouble. Right, it was a kind of financial distress signal. We are in trouble. Terrible things are going to happen unless we get to change the system in a fundamental way. And people here sat and said, okay, we can kind of understand that. But this time around, after years of hearing about record revenues, great revenue increases, seeing the Atlanta situation fixed by going to Winnipeg. So in Canada, that seems self-evident. You take a team in a place where they don't care about it, put it in a place where they care about it passionately, and guess what? You make money. That it's going to be hard for people to look at this and say, is this about anything other than trying to claw back a few bucks and put it in their pocket? Because that's what it appears.
And what I'd say is I agree 100% what this negotiation, my own view of this negotiation was a far less significant ask than the last negotiation, right? I think the way I look at this is we're making adjustments to a system that has worked very well for everybody. And that will benefit the players long term. So I didn't view this to be the type of negotiation we were dealing with last time.
Can I go back to something you said earlier? And Stephen went in another direction, and it was worthwhile. Very early on in this conversation, you talked about a level of optimism going into these negotiations that hasn't materialized. And I assume that's optimism once Don came on board and maybe early conversations that you'd had, et cetera. Because you thought we wouldn't be at this point. What was that optimism based on? Was it based on Don Fear? Was it based on casual conversations? Do you think it's gone off the rails?
I think it was more based on the magnitude of the changes we were looking for, because I didn't view them to be as great as they're being portrayed. I still don't view them to be as great as they're being portrayed. I don't think
players to take 43%.
This is a dollars and cents negotiation. Yeah, and it's also a negotiation.
Yeah, I get that. Okay.
And David Stern asked for 39% as his opening position.
Okay, I get that. But I had to bring that up.
And we've lived with 43% for 7 years and have to pay the cost on top of it. So, no. I mean,
the irony was not lost on us of the opening offer, by the way. But where did your optimism come from?
It really came from the magnitude of what I thought this negotiation was about. I did think it was more about fine-tuning what we had created and developed, and for whatever reason, it's obviously viewed differently on the other side of the table.
Brunt and I have been through a bunch of these. Well, you've been through a couple of them in various sports, and there seems to always have been a pattern. The sides meet. There are these long bargaining sessions. Sometimes, but there's long bargaining sessions. You guys come out and you're all disheveled. Your tie is sideways when you're wearing it. And you go, we didn't deal with the main issues, but we've managed to solve, paragraph 622, which was a big problem, which was whether to tie your shoes left over right or right over left. And so we're working on it. And you go through all these irrelevant little tidbitty things. And then eventually at the 11th hour, you'd get to the big issue. And either you could solve it or you can't. Am I wrong in reading this thing as like you guys aren't even talking to each other?
You're not wrong right now. I mean, discussions are happening at some level, and there's substantive discussions in terms of how we move this forward and what the various positions have been on some of the major points.
Okay.
The dialogue has not shut down. But what I would say is I think a large portion of the summer was spent actually plowing that ground that you're talking about, the littler issues, the ancillary issues, some of the issues that I know the players feel passionately about and probably make a lot of sense for us to be very reasonable on in the context of an overall deal. But you get to a certain point where the critical issues, and clearly for us, we have a, you know, I could count them on one hand probably, a number of critical issues, weren't being addressed in a meaningful way. Certainly we weren't making progress on them. And then you have to reach that point, you pare away the other issues and you say, let's see if we're going to make progress on this. Because if we can get to that point, then I think everything else becomes fairly easy. And I would distinguish this negotiation from our last one in that regard, in the sense that, you know, we got to the cap and we got the right number. The right number turned out to be the wrong number. But when we worked all that out, we had an entire negotiation to do in terms of everything else in the CBA and what it meant. Again, we plowed a lot of that ground in this negotiation already, and I don't think we're overhauling the entire system. I think they're mostly, in the tweak category.
There seems to be a difference of opinion about the relevance of the NBA and NFL deals to this deal. Don Fehr said it's not relevant, that this is, the NHL has its own history and its own labor history, and this deal exists as part of that. And I think Gary made reference to kind of resetting the bar in those two sports. Explain what you're thinking on that.
Well, I think there's certainly some relevance. I can't argue that it's totally divorced. I think it probably goes to what you pointed to, Stephen, which is, you know, the world changes over time and the world's different today than it was 7 years ago. And I think the reality is you have to make adjustments to reflect the fact that the world is different. So in that regard, it's relevant. I mean, I have a tough time. I understand the argument intellectually that the players gave an enormous amount last time, and I would be the last one to suggest that they weren't big concessions. But I'm not sure that's really relevant to what we collectively need to do to make the sport healthy going forward for the benefit of the players. So, you know, the fact that they gave it the office last time means they shouldn't have to give it the office this time. I mean, you know, you should be doing what you need to do to move the sport forward. And so each negotiation stands on its own, and what happened last time should be irrelevant to what we need this time. And what happened the time before that should be irrelevant.
We got to take a break. We'll come back to that.
Yep.
The Deputy Commissioner of the National Hockey League, Bill Daly, is with us, and Primetime will continue on the Fan Radio Network Coast to Coast and on Sportsnet. Before I so rudely interrupted him, Mr. Brunt was in mid-question.
It was a very long segment, so I'm glad you did.
Pick it up where you left.
No, Bill, you talked about, you know, the players just giving it the office, kind of, they gave last time, and maybe they have to give a little bit this time in order to make for a healthy business. The other side of that would be, you know, revenue sharing on the owner's side. I wonder how far apart you are now in terms of revenue sharing proposals and, you know, how significant that is in terms of, you know, the revenue disparities in the league. We're talking about haves and have-nots in the NHL all the time. If you can even things out a bit more on the revenue side, you know, the cost side maybe is not quite as much of an issue.
You ask how far apart we are. I'd like to think, and certainly we think legitimately, that we're not that far apart. The Players Association say publicly that we are, and even privately they say we are. So that's, they're not saying anything they don't say to us, but I don't see it. I mean, they've basically made one proposal. That was the August 14th proposal. It had an in-depth revenue sharing program in there. The basic principles of the programs between what we've proposed and what they put on the table are similar. It has more money coming from big market teams and going to the clubs in distress. Our proposal contemplates increasing the pool fairly significantly. It contemplates giving more money to more franchises who were excluded under this current system. And it contemplates addressing the clawback issue where, we put in certain incentives or thresholds clubs had to meet to get full shares.
Revenue and attendance, clawback. Right, yeah.
And we had proposed dealing with that differently and kind of more focused on clubs operating optimally locally by putting experts in there and helping them grow their revenues.
Bill, how is that not reorganizing the deck chairs on the Titanic? What's the fundamental significance of that to the Players Association? With due respect, because I don't understand how that matters.
Well, I think that, I mean, they're, what, revenue sharing generally? I mean, look, their focus on revenue sharing is you've got a couple problems that you need to address, and our revenue sharing program will help address those. I would suggest our revenue sharing program would help address them in the same way.
Well, and I would suggest that my revenue sharing program would address them better because you lop off two teams and move two, and then you got no problems at all.
Not surprising that the Players Association hasn't proposed
the lopping off
the lopping off part.
Yeah. It is always been my observation since you signed this last deal that the greatest economic hardship was not the cap, it was the floor. The greatest miscalculation was not the ceiling, it was the floor. The guarantee that certain teams who could not afford to pay the minimum were now paying the minimum, and then the minimum kept going up and up and up and up. Can you address that? Do you share that sentiment? Could you create a deal where the floor and the ceiling had a greater parameter, a greater difference?
I don't entirely share that view. I think the revenue sharing program is designed to address that issue and to give those clubs whose local revenues may not put them in a position to afford the floor And that's the theory behind the revenue sharing program. So if you have the right revenue sharing program, I think the floor makes perfect sense. I think the floor is a necessary element of this system. I think it's added to the competitive balance, the unprecedented competitive balance we've had. And that's why, you know, lopping off the floor, eliminating it entirely is not something we would ever contemplate. But the fact of the matter, the fact that the floor has always been $16 million below the cap, regardless of where the cap's gone,
yeah,
is a separate issue. And that's something that some general managers have raised with us over time. It's something that the Players Association actually put in their proposal that perhaps it should be a percentage as opposed to a hard dollar number. And it's something our second proposal contemplated. It's something we'd certainly be prepared to consider as part of a deal.
Mr. Brunt will acknowledge that this has taken place. That sounds beautifully. It's beautifully said. But functionally, it doesn't work. And here's how it doesn't work. Is because you have teams like the Florida Panthers, who when Dale Talon took over as the general manager, had to spend like a wild banshee just to get to the floor. And by his own acknowledgement, spent way more on certain guys than he ever should have. But he was like he had to spend that much money. So the Prince, and he's not alone. The Columbus Blue Jackets in a similar kind of situation. I mean, you wind up giving money to guys and giving them more money than they're worth, and it creates this ridiculous inequity out there. The principle of the floor, I don't like, but it doesn't work, does it, Bill?
Yeah, I don't buy that. I mean, I you can point to the odd case, and I'd like to hear what Dale said because I'm not sure that's really his view or an accurate portrayal of what he said. But I can pick the odd case where a club may have to sign a player it doesn't need. But as a practical matter, I think, and as a matter over 7 years, it has helped clubs be competitive and compete. And I think that's important from a league-wide perspective.
Steven.
Well, I don't want to go back and go through history too much, but you guys had pretty good competitive balance when you had a market-based system too, as all of those Leafs and Rangers Stanley Cups would attest when they had the two highest payrolls in the game, right? They didn't win anything.
I have a different view of that. I think if you looked at the last 15 years before our last deal, you would pick the same five or six teams every year that would be competing for a Stanley Cup.
But you had more diversity.
Wouldn't be.
I think I haven't got the numbers in front of me, but the diversity, the number of teams who won divisions one and were in the playoffs over that stretch, I think compares favorably with every other sport.
If you look at conference final participants and final participants, that's not in fact the case.
If you could roll back the clock, Bill, and have a market-based system where you controlled players from 18 to 31 like you guys used to, would you take it?
No.
How come?
Well, again, because I think the system itself has worked as we intended it to work. It has made all the clubs competitive, and the product's never been better. And I would say in part because the teams are so equal. So I think the sport and everybody in the sport, including the players, have benefited from the system. You know, the economics are wrong.
You guys dodged when baseball shut down, the players' strike and everything that happened in 94, 95, baseball play, there's huge collateral damage in baseball outside of a few very strong core baseball markets. Their fringe markets suffered greatly, and it took for a long time to recover. You guys, it didn't happen. By and large, you came out of the lockout and were stronger, and your revenues, as your revenues would have passed. Are you worried about that this time around, that you know you got away with it last time, but maybe not twice?
Sure. I think we have to be.
Nah, you are not. You're fearless, and you have every reason to be fearless.
No.
The threat of a lockout used to be this terrible cloud that hung over every negotiation. I'm not just talking about your sport. I'm talking about every sport. What if they don't play? What if there's no championship? What if they go out for a year? How long before the fans will come back and we can crank this business back up? 4 years, 5 years, and then you did it. And guess what? Like a switch, they came back. I wouldn't be the least bit afraid of staying out for a year or 2 years if I was you guys. There's no evidence to support the theory that there's anything, there's long-term ramifications from it.
Well, I mean, I think Stephen's example is a good example. I think it took baseball years to recover from losing the World Series in 1994, 95, whenever it was. Knock on wood, it didn't happen to us, but it doesn't mean it can't happen to us.
Didn't happen in the NFL. They didn't wipe out a Super Bowl.
They didn't miss any games either.
Well, they've missed games. They've had but they didn't have this last year.
In the past, they missed games. But that's going way back, right?
Yeah, I get that. But still.
1989, I think, was the last time they lost.
Well, I wouldn't be afraid if I were you.
Okay.
Maximum contract length for individual contracts. Is that a big issue?
I think as one of a number of kind of system adjustments is an important issue.
What do you think that number should be? What are you guys proposing?
Well, we've proposed five.
Five?
Mm-hmm.
So you'd settle it something around that, probably.
You know, I want to leave the actual bargaining and negotiations.
You don't
want to
do it here? Come on.
But, you know, what we've explained to the players is that once you get the share, right, all the other issues are really allocational issues. They're not, it doesn't affect the overall number of dollars going to the players. They're going to get what they get. We have a unique system in that regard. We guarantee the players a certain number every year. So it becomes an allocational issue in how you disperse the dollars as among players. And, you know, to the extent there's a misallocation of some of the player salaries, as some of our general managers think there is, particularly with respect to players with bargaining leverage coming out of the entry-level system and how what kind of dollars those players are getting and what kind of terms they're getting. Some of our general managers think that's a bad thing for the game, that more deserving players aren't getting those dollars and should be. So that's something we should have a joint interest in solving.
What do you do with contracts that don't fit whatever the new model is? In other words, guy signs a 10-year contract, you got a 5-year limit. Cap is X amount, top percentage for any individual players. If you're still at 20%, now he's over that amount. Do you grandfather anything in here?
We'd love to have that problem. I mean, look, there comes to the issue of transition rules and what you need to do to get from this world to that world.
Yeah.
Want to get to those.
Yeah.
You know, look, I don't think anything's unsolvable. And I think there are lots of creative ways to deal with how to get from this world to that world. Those are the least of our problems right now.
But what should people make, you know, again, in the hockey world, what should people make of the contracts that were signed right up until the verge of, right up to the edge of this lockout, which would have exceeded the term limit you're talking about and, you know, were incredibly lucrative and were being, in some cases, were being coughed up by franchises that have been takers on the revenue sharing side historically. What if you're a fan, you look at that and say, hang on, how can these two things be reconciled?
And it's tough sometimes to reconcile them. I think it goes to kind of individual competitiveness, individual desire to be successful on the ice and trying to create relationships and use the rules that are in front of you and looking to the league and the Players Association to work on kind of the macro issues and rules going forward. And so it's to that extent, it's a little bit apples and oranges, but I certainly understand the perception.
We've got to get out of here. In conclusion, any talks scheduled?
We're supposed to talk again tomorrow. We haven't set up a formal meeting, but hopefully soon.
But there are people, as you suggested earlier, there are conversations going on at some level on some kind of ongoing basis.
Yes.
So you haven't exactly shut down the doors of communication.
And I would distinguish from the prior negotiation that as well. I think the dialogue is open.
Is the ball in the Players Association court so the next offer will come from them?
I hope so. I mean, look, we've, as I said, their first proposal has been their only proposal, really, which is the August 14th proposal. They really haven't moved off of that, and we need to see some movement.
Well, on behalf of hockey fans, go back to work. Get this thing done.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
The Deputy Commissioner of the National Hockey League, Bill Daly.